Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massive hurricane making landfall on Florida's southwest coast as we go to air and speak with Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida. A longtime resident of Florida who has experienced many hurricanes, she is just north of Tampa, which is poised to suffer a direct hit from Hurricane Irma, but her house is on high ground and she will be hunkering down to ride out the storm. Since Tampa has not seen a direct hit from a major hurricane in almost a century, we will discuss how state and local authorities have handled the looming disaster and whether those who evacuated Miami and sought shelter in Tampa will be in harm's way as the storm surge is expected to impact Tampa Bay with a wall of water between 10 and 15 feet high. Then we'll get an update on the latest revelations about Russia's active measures campaign to influence the last election, which, while it has sown chaos in the United States and could lead to more political paralysis and possibly a constitutional crisis involving the 25th Amendment or even an impeachment, this multifaceted intelligence operation has also impacted politics in Russia with blowback that has Putin on the defensive, having overreached massively, while the leader of the far-right New Russia movement is on state TV threatening to, quote, hit Donald Trump with our compromat. A veteran former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who is now the national security analyst on CNN, joins us to discuss the growing weight of evidence that a vast Russian intelligence operation targeted U.S. democracy in 2016, and now its architect, Vladimir Putin, may well have buyer's remorse. Then finally, we will speak with Asha Rangappa, Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence operations. She joins us to discuss her article, Politico, How Facebook Changed the Spy Game, and assess at what point will all the dots be connected to reveal the full scope of the Russian active measures operation as breaking news dribbles out almost daily, revealing more incriminating details. And joining us now is Dr. Susan McManus, who's the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and co-author of Florida's Politics and One Powerful State and Young versus Old Generational Combat in the 21st Century. She has served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan McManus.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I know you're fairly preoccupied. You're just north of Tampa, which is expected to get a direct hit. And I take it you've just moved to your sister's house, which is on higher ground, as is your house. So why did you just move to your sister's house?
I have a large oak tree in the front of my house that's massive. It's been there for nearly 90-plus years. My grandfather was a pioneer in the area, and the wind could just directly dump that tree right on my house. So I moved over to my sister's, also lives in an old Florida house, but she doesn't have all the large trees right around her immediate home.
And given that the storm is expected to impact Tampa and you're just north of there, the fact that there hasn't been a major hurricane hit Tampa in almost 100 years, do you think that the city's prepared, or do you feel prepared?
I feel prepared, and I think the city is as prepared as can be. There have been nonstop get-out, move, evacuation orders for days on end now. Plus, on the heels of watching the visuals from Houston, Harvey, I think that also was a motivation for some people to get out. Within a couple days, as soon as they announced that it was moving to the West Coast, because initially we thought it was going to the East Coast, it was in a couple hours, and all the bread was sold out of grocery stores, all the ice, the gas stations were running short of gas till they had to bring some in an emergency with the escort of the highway patrol bringing big tankers into the state so people could fill up to evacuate even further. There are still some people who are walking on the beach this morning. I just saw somebody, we would have some names for them, but I probably can't use them on the phone in a nice interview. But I think for the most part, people have done what they can do. There are, however, a lot of people who've moved in here have never experienced a hurricane of any sort. Now, we had two seasons of four hurricanes each in the early 2000s, 2004 and whatever. But there are still a lot of people that this is their first time going through one, and they are absolutely more panicked than most, not unexpectedly.
Well, the mayor of Tampa, Bob Buckhorn, is saying we're about to get punched in the face by this storm. We need to be prepared. My understanding is that a lot of people evacuated from Miami on the East Coast, thinking that that was going to be impacted, and now they're in Tampa.
Right, and what we've seen even this morning is suddenly people saying, you know, I can get to Orlando, the other side of the I-4 corridor, you know, which obviously has political definitions, but for day right now nobody's thinking politics. So what you do see are some people that have decided, even this morning, to try to make a quick dash over to Tampa, and in listening to some of the radio casts just now, the highways are pretty empty, so you could get over there in an hour and a half. The question is that really going to help you all that much? Because the width of the storm encompasses, you know, is larger than the width of Florida from coast to coast. But you still see people who thought it was coming east, and now it's coming here, and they're trying to move out when they can.
So is there an expectation, though, that Tampa Bay, the hurricane's going to be funneled up Tampa Bay and then just sort of take a surge of water north with it? And you're north of Tampa Bay, so...
I am, but I'm a little bit more inland from the coast. I'm due north of Tampa, which gets me into Middle Pasco County, which is Land O'Lakes. And we are not directly on the coast. We're not likely to experience any kind of coast-related surge here, but people on the coast will. And that is frightening. Two things are frightening people the most. One is if you live on that water on the coast, and you know, 80% of Floridians live within 10 miles of the coast, to give you a perspective on the coast. But they're the ones who are afraid of storm surge, and the wind is more of a danger to the interior. So I'm in the part of the state which is on the part that they're expecting the largest winds from. So where I am, I'm more concerned about wind damage than water, but the coast is just the opposite.
So, in general, what's your sense of how the state and local authorities have coped with this situation? And it's worth mentioning that there's another hurricane following in the path of Irma. So this could be a 1-2 punch. But given how badly this hurricane has impacted Cuba and Barbuda and other in the Virgin Islands, along with, of course, the Keys, and nobody quite knows what's happened in the Florida Keys yet. They got a direct impact for reasons which are mystifying to me. A lot of people actually stayed behind, and that's only a few feet above water, that entire Florida Keys. So it's obviously
that's mystifying even to Floridians, uh-huh, that someone would stay in the Keys. Absolutely, it does not make a lot of sense.
So what is your assessment in terms of how things have been handled, given that this storm is kind of, this hurricane has done a bait and switch, and instead of hitting the East Coast, it's hit the West Coast?
I have to give high marks to the media of all sorts, radio, television in particular, nonstop coverage since the path had changed and we saw where it was coming. The officials have opened shelters. They've closed schools to make shelters. Last night, they in a lot of the area here, they even brought in more water and whatever to supply the shelters. I think we're up to 400 shelters open right now in the Tampa area. And schools have been canceled at least through Tuesday. The governor, who some people do not like politically, has gotten high marks from everyone. He's been directing people to take resources to various places. It's come on the newscast repeatedly telling people, please get out. And the first responders have arrived already. My sister lived a while in Pikeville, Tennessee, and just got a text that some of the Pikeville, Tennessee EMS people are actually in Tampa. You really see the good in people during storms like this. And we saw it in Houston, the humanity in a lot of people comes to the forefront. And everybody's in the same boat, so I think that helps people sort of remember that golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's really meaningful in times like this.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, who's the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics and One Powerful State and Young versus Old Generational Combat in the 21st Century. She served as the chair of the Florida Elections Commission and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. So in terms of electricity, obviously, there's a couple of nuclear power plants, that one of which was damaged back in 1992 by Hurricane Andrew. That's the Turkey Point. That's being closed down, and another one, St. Lucie, north of West Palm Beach, is being closed down. So how's the electrical supply? Has there been any blackouts in that you know of?
Yes, there's already been, 800,000 plus down in the south part of the state, the Miami Keys area are without power. It's projected that almost half of Florida will be without power, but what is also impressive is that the power companies have already built staging areas for crews. They've got their crews stationed all over because they know there's going to be these terrible loss of electric with these high winds. It is true that after Hurricane Andrew, which was the last horrible one that hit South Florida, that the state laws have required that stronger power poles be put in place in areas of high likelihood of storms, and so we're going to be seeing some of that, how well a lot of the changes to bolster up the utilities in times like this, how well that's working after having put them in place. We haven't had any tests until now. So a lot of things interesting, but nearly everyone is expecting loss of power. That's a given. What is very disconcerting to people who haven't lived through one of these before is the fact that you might be out of power for a week or two or longer, and that is really very, very scary to a lot of people.
So the storm is expected to reach Naples at 5 p.m., and it's about 2 p.m. now. So what's your sense of, let me ask you this. Are you boarded up, or are you able to look outside?
I'm looking outside, and I live on a pond, and it's the wind on the ponds and the breeze. I mean, we just got, within the last 20 minutes, we had what we would call a frog strangler kind of storm where you can't even see. It's so hard, the rain and the wind. And then that died down, and that's the nature of this. The gusts come and go. It is the case that already Naples area has been experiencing gusts of over 100 miles per hour. And it's supposed to possibly go up to 140 or so in that area. Even the television coverage comes and goes depending upon the storms and the satellites, etc.
Right.
So everybody's kind of hunkered down. I was out on the highway about 2 hours ago. I went to take some food to some elderly people at my church, and it was calm as anything, and by the time I got home, the rains and the wind had started, and now they're calm again. That's the nature of the storm.
But in about 3 hours or so, it's going to get a lot worse, right?
Yes. Every newscast that you listen to, whether it's NOAA, I'm on NOAA, I have a weather radio, anyway, saying stay hunkered down. Your chances to really move around are now pretty much gone. And pretty soon you'll start to see flooding of roads and stuff, which create other kinds of transport issues. And so a lot of people are just in their homes, and some of them are watching football. A lot of people, though, are watching hurricane coverage.
But some of these homes aren't like your house or your sister's house where you are now, which is on higher ground.
Right.
Even if it's a two-story house, it's still, we hear so many stories of people being trapped in attics, etc. So
Right. And what you have seen within the last 24 hours are people who initially said they weren't going to bother to board up their windows. Mm. I was talking to a friend this morning who said yesterday morning he was the only one that was putting plywood on his windows. And then within, you know, 3 or 4 hours and once the early afternoon, everybody was wanting to board up their windows. And, of course, it's hard to get plywood right now. But people who've lived here a long while know the nature of their home. They know the nature of the propensity to flooding. They know what closes, what doesn't in terms of bridges and what washes out in terms of roads. It's the newcomers that are the most concern to the first responders, to the governor, to everyone, because they haven't lived through this, and it's really hard to describe one until you've lived through one.
But I understand that a lot of the architecture hasn't really adapted to hurricanes. You still have sort of high roofs. You don't have those kind of palapas like they do in Mexico and other places where you get the wind, and the wind can go right through the house as opposed to being hitting surfaces that are too blunt to get.
Right. So you still do have a bit of that housing, but the good news is a lot of the newer housing, and during the last post-Andrew, we've had massive growth and a lot of new subdivisions and new housing have been built, and they've had to be built to a different building code and a higher standard, supposedly to be able to withstand hurricanes more. And that's what many, many, many people are watching as to how effective were those new building codes in handling a catastrophe like this.
So just obviously you mentioned the Governor Scott is not popular with some people, but he's doing a good job.
Yes, and he's gotten very high accolades from nearly everyone, because this is not a time for politics. I think we learned that in Houston, and we're certainly seeing it here. Mm-hmm. It is not a time when people can focus on that. If they did, they would lose votes if it were the election right after. People do not appreciate politics in the middle of a catastrophe or hurricane.
Right, but that doesn't limit you and I to at least discuss the broader issues, which is that what we noticed in Houston was that almost the entire delegation, I think the entire congressional delegation, the two senators, the governor and the lieutenant governor, were all, you know, global warming deniers. And you do have this strange situation where politicians who deny global warming are very quick to deal with the aftermath of these storms, but they don't want to talk about what causes them in the first place. And is that also a part of Florida's politics? Because
you have seen some of that. The governor has been, you know, would be classified like the people in Houston. And there's been some mention of it, because Governor Scott is likely to run for the U.S. Senate in 2018 against the sitting longtime Democrat U.S. Senator from Florida, Bill Nelson. And so I've seen just a very, you know, every day or so a couple of stories about the climate positions of Scott, but it's frankly mostly been in newspapers, and it really has not. And I watch a lot of different kinds of media and listen to it. I have not heard a lot or seen a lot about it on the television that most people are watching.
And is Bill Nelson vulnerable, do you think?
Well, as usual, it's regarded as one of the most competitive races in the entire country, the assumption that the governor's going to enter, because I always remind people that the last four elections in Florida, two governor's races and the two most recent presidential, the margin of victory has only been 1%. And that's why, once again, this is expected to be a very competitive state next year politically. Mm-hmm. We have an open governor's seat. We have a hot U.S. Senate race. We have all three open cabinet positions, which are statewide, the attorney general, chief financial officer, and the ag commissioner, plus some very hot congressional races and a slew of legislative races. So yes, it's going to be, Florida is going to sustain its position nationally as the nation's really most competitive state year in and year out.
Well, of course, the most prominent resident, albeit a part-time resident of Florida, is Donald Trump. And I don't know that Mar-a-Lago is being impacted, but there's another storm coming, and it's hard not to see, if there's not a pattern here, at least this is a highly unusual weather event, and we just seem to be getting more and more unusual weather events. And at what point do people put two and two together?
Yeah, and at the same time, you have the continual fires in the west and tornadoes in the mid part of the state, country. So, you know, you clearly see climate is escalating as an issue, particularly since it's a higher priority for the millennials than any other generation. And now, even in Florida, the millennials are the largest portion of our workforce, and they're making up, the millennials admit it, and Gen Xers made up 50% of Florida's registered voters last year. So the climate, no question, is escalating, as is the environment in general, as an issue in Florida.
Well, Dr. Susan McManus, I wish you all the best. You've got a couple of hours of calm before the storm, but I hope you and your sister ride it out. And let's get back to you later and see how things went.
Well, thank you so much for your concern, and we appreciate all of the United States thinking about us in Florida here. We certainly need everybody's prayers and good thoughts, so thank you.
Well, thank you again, and I've been speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics and One Powerful State and Young versus Old, Generational Combat in the 21st Century. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. And we're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the latest revelations about Russia's active measures campaign to influence the last election.
There's been a crash on the levee, and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And as a former CIA officer, I was interested in getting your impression of this Russian active measures campaign, which just shortly after the elections, all 17 U.S. Intelligence agencies said was conducted by Russia at the direction of President Putin. And my understanding is that it could have been budgeted as high as $5 billion. We don't get a full picture of it yet because the news dribbles out bits and pieces, little aspects of it, almost on a daily basis. So how would you compare it or see it in the light of what you know about American intelligence operations?
Well, the way I look at it, first of all, you have to be deluded not to understand the Russians got in the middle of our elections. And the more we hear about this, the clearer it is they tipped the elections in Trump's favor. I don't know that they thought they could really do this or how vulnerable we were on Facebook and Twitter and disinformation. The last covert action campaign of this magnitude was the CIA's support of the rebels in Afghanistan, which tipped the breakup of the Soviet Union. And if we want to look at it this way, it's payback, and that's what we got. This has been the most disruptive covert action in this country ever in our history, except for the revolution. You know, let's face it, it was brilliant on the part of the Russians. And Ian, we've talked about this. We know why they did it. It's more payback for the Ukraine, for Crimea, for the Baltics. The Russians, Putin in particular, thinks we broke the agreement that Gorbachev had made, breaking up the Soviet Union, that we would sort of leave NATO out of Eastern Europe and the Baltics and the rest of it. So, you know, from a Russian perspective, they feel they had to do this. What's surprising in this is we have not reacted to it, or Americans haven't accepted that what the Russians managed to accomplish, which I find just remarkable. And, you know, putting $5 billion into disrupting American politics and probably leading to a constitutional crisis is a drop in the bucket for the Russians.
Well, one of the criticisms is that why would Putin have expected Trump to win when everybody thought he would lose and Hillary Clinton would win? So it's not inconceivable that, to my mind, that Putin didn't necessarily expect Trump to win. And had Trump lost, he still would have served Russians' interests, wouldn't he? Because he would have been out with his 35% base in this country saying, lock her up at every turn, and it would have diminished her ability to govern.
Oh, Ian, I agree with that. I mean, we don't know all that the Russians have, what they've actually hacked. And I think this is my speculation, is that they just hoped to tie up Hillary Clinton when she was president. There's no way that the Russians could have predicted that their actions would have got Trump elected. I think it came as a surprise. The only person that didn't come as a surprise what was happening was Bill Clinton, who said 4 weeks before, you're going to lose this election. But the Russians couldn't have known that. They couldn't have predicted it. And all they wanted to do was tie her up, you know, with the email scandal, with, the crazies on the hard right and the rest of it, because she was looked at as a cold warrior out to get the Russians. And, you know, her actions in the Ukraine as Secretary of State was enough to make her a permanent enemy of Vladimir Putin. And I think that's the best explanation until we get more evidence. I like to call Trump from time to time the Manchurian candidate, but that's too simplistic. I don't think the man is governable by anybody, and he's an opportunist. And I think it's pretty clear the Russian oligarchs bailed him out, laundered money through his business. I mean, nobody would give Trump a loan on Wall Street for his business. They just didn't trust him. And then the Russians come along. They run money through Trump enterprises. They get it laundered, and they get a certain hold on this guy. And this is the way the world works, and it's the way Russian intelligence works. And it does no good at all to, to damn Putin and, say he's an evil guy. He's a Russian patriot. And, I think we have to accept him as that.
Well, my understanding is I talked to some Russians who didn't want to go on the air because things are very sensitive over there, that what really flipped out Putin and just sent him into a rage was the Panama Papers that revealed $8 billion of his money, probably in the name of his friend, the cellist, the guy that plays the cello, who has, there are not many cellists in the world with $8 billion in the bank. And that's apparently, he thought that was actually Hillary Clinton's work. And when, in fact, it was an international consortium of investigative journalists that broke the Panama Papers story. So, and again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers and is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. So as much as you say that Putin is a Russian patriot and you think he's obviously pretty clever, although he was a minor apparatchik in the KGB, the talented ones went to London, Washington, Bonn, London, etc., and New York. But nevertheless, he did have some senior FSB people working for him who he looked up to, like Ivanov, his former chief of staff. But apparently Ivanov warned him against this active measures campaign to influence the American elections. He thought it was reckless and would result in blowback. Putin apparently didn't listen to him. He listened to the Young Turks and the old hardliners. And now there are rumors that Putin is having buyer's remorse. It's all blown up in his face. He's overreached. And he's really in a bit of a bind.
I think everything I'm hearing, he's got buyer's remorse. You have this hard right member of the Duma talking about having compromise on Trump, and they're going to release it. And I think Putin, as the Chinese and everybody really are, is that Trump's going to talk us into a nuclear exchange with North Korea, which would be a catastrophe for everybody because the Chinese would be drawn in. There would be no limit to a war like that. And Putin is saying, wait a minute, this isn't what wasn't I bargained for. So if Ivanov turned out to have been right, you know, there's always blowback in covert action, just like we got blowback out of Afghanistan supporting the Takfiri jihadists. You know, it ended up in 9/11, basically. You know, giving these people wind. So there is blowback, and Putin has figured this out. And the real question is, if in fact, and no one's seen it for sure, if he's got compromise, whether it's tapes or financial, on Trump, would he take this stuff and just push it out there in the public and get Trump tied up in a constitutional crisis? In order to avoid a nuclear war, if the calculations would be that simple. And we're just going to have to wait and see, but it's certainly a possibility.
Well, I'm not sure of the logic of that, though. If you got an unstable president with the nuclear codes, and apparently...
Well, that's true.
He's lost his best friend, the bodyguard, Schiller.
Schiller, yeah.
Yeah, who's apparently his anchor. And then on top of that, he's getting pressure. I mean, it's a scary situation because there is no impediment between Trump and the nuclear bomb.
I see that too. I mean, his allying with Nancy Pelosi on lifting the national debt he's got everybody confused. I mean, who knows where he stands on anything?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he knows. And he's clearly, you know, to call the Manchurian candidate, he wouldn't be the ideal one for the Russians. But at some point, the Russians are going to say enough is enough. I mean, they could even turn to fabricating information just to stir things up and hoping that Trump resigns. I mean, this is giving him an out. If you gave Mueller and the FBI enough information, they could go to Trump and say, look, we can do this the hard way or the easy way, and he might, you know. But again, you're absolutely right. The man is unpredictable.
Right. Well, even if they threatened to put his family in jail, knowing Trump, he has no loyalty to anybody. But let's talk a little bit about the possibility that Putin could sort of reinvent himself from being the arsonist and turn into the fire brigade in terms of the active measures campaign against the American election. You mentioned the Russian politician. He was on the state broadcast media, Russia 24, Nikita Isayev. He's a leader of the far-right New Russia movement, and he was on their popular political show, Screenshot. And he threatened on Russian television to hit Donald Trump with our kompromat. And then he was asked whether Russia has kompromat on Trump. And as I have said, and he's also the director, by the way, of the Russian Institute for Contemporary Economics, he replied, of course we have it. So that's got to make Trump nervous. If all of this stuff in the Steele dossier, or if any of the stuff in the Steele dossier is true, with the six young Russian girls in the Ritz-Rude Hotel presidential suite and all this other stuff that we've heard about for some time, I don't know. Do you think the 35% of Trump supporters, what would it take for them? Would they have to see graphic pornographic television in order to get the message?
Well, it's like the, you know, Nixon's tapes. Once they heard it on, you know, the cover up on tape, that pretty well did it for most people. So I think a graphic video of Trump, or you know, a clear case of indictable money laundering for the Russian mob, it'll do it for a lot of them. But look at it this way: if Trump is forced out of office, we're going to be tied up in some sort of constitutional crisis. If the Russians let it out that they tipped the elections, does that mean that Pence is legitimately, you know, his successor? Because the whole election under the guarantee clause has to be a free and fair election. Otherwise, the results are you know, not legitimate. I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but there's this argument out there, and Lawrence Tribe is pushing it, that this wasn't a free and fair election. But I would let him speak for himself.
Sure, but the more that we learn of the multifaceted active measures campaign with this latest story about Facebook, which seems like, and as Senator Warner and the Intelligence Committee said, it's only the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that went on, and we don't know the extent, for example, to which Jill Stein played a role. I mean, Jill Stein obviously was there at the same table with Michael Flynn at the RT banquet in Moscow. And, you know, there in the Steele dossier, it says that the Russians financed Jill Stein's campaign. And if they did, that was probably the most cost-effective thing that Putin did if he wanted to hurt Hillary, because Jill Stein's Green Party got more votes in those three key swing states that Hillary Clinton lost by 77,000 votes. She got more votes and therefore really did tip the election for Trump.
Yeah, you're right. It's right there. She tipped the election. No one has even touched this at that point. And there's no reason that Trump would have even known about Jill Stein being financed by the Russians, if indeed that was the case. But, you know, I could tell you, if I were still in the CIA and pulled off a covert operation like this, I'd be director. I mean, it's just fantastic what the Russians did. It's equally fantastic the Americans don't care about their independence, or a lot of Americans don't, or the Republicans in particular. I mean, what happened to their national security credentials and not demanding a copy of his tax returns? I mean, it's a world I don't understand now.
Well, it's very odd, I agree. And even in the testimony by James Comey, the FBI director, there was he obviously was troubled by the lack of interest, it seems, in what Russia did amongst the political class, particularly the Republicans. But he singled out President Trump himself, you know, who's absolutely said nothing about, you know, what we should be doing after having been attacked in this way. And it's a fundamental attack on the very nature of American democracy.
Yeah, or nothing is put, no defenses are being built right now for the 2018 election, which, you know, you can count on anybody, the Russians, the North Koreans even, you know, getting into these elections. And you know, if we're not willing to defend our borders and our democratic process, we are inching toward the, you know, the sort of the end of the republic. That's the way I look at it.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing at what point will all the dots be connected to reveal the full scope of the Russian active measures campaign operation to tip the last elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who is the Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the FBI, at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations. And she has an article at Politico, How Facebook Changed the Spy Game. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thank you for joining us, Asha. And what's your sense of whether or when and if we'll get a full picture of Russia's active measures campaign, which clearly was a massive investment on the part of the Russian intelligence services. According to our all 17 of our intelligence services, it was directed by Vladimir Putin himself. We were discussing earlier with a former CIA officer whether or not Putin himself was having buyer's remorse, because it's obviously there's been an enormous amount of blowback. But this latest revelations about fake Russians planting fake news stories in via Facebook seems to me just to be a part of the overall picture. The New York Times did an investigation on Russian involvement in the hacking into voter rolls in some of the key swing states, etc. That's still under investigation. When do you think there'll be a fuller picture of this? Was clearly a multifaceted operation on the part of the Russians.
Yes, it's clear that they were operating on many fronts, and I think this would make sense. They would be exploring a lot of different avenues and seeing which would succeed and which might not. You know, they're not going to put all their eggs in one basket. As far as when we'll get a full accounting, I wouldn't hold your breath, Ian. These active measures are ongoing. This is an active counterintelligence investigation that the FBI would be conducting in conjunction with the CIA and NSA. And as a result, they're going to be using all of their methods and sources to try to understand all of these different avenues. As you said, there are multiple ones, and to try to neutralize any other operations that the Russians might continue having at this moment. And so there's a bit of a tension between the public's right and desire to know and the intelligence community being effective in neutralizing Russia's operations, because obviously our leverage comes from not letting them know what we know. If they know what we know, they just change tactics, and all of our intelligence starts drying up. So I think you might see bits and pieces here and there, like the Facebook piece, things that might that could come up on the criminal side with Mueller that kind of intimate, like with this meeting, the Russia meeting at the Trump Tower. But I think for there to be a full accounting, at some point Congress is going to have to appoint an independent commission, much like they did with September 11th, that will take the time to basically get the whole picture and then be able to produce a report that can take into account classified information, sensitive sources, things that might be ongoing, and balance that with giving a full picture of what happened.
Well, in his testimony, James Comey, the former director of the FBI, who presumably knows as much, if not more than anybody, about what the Russians were up to, he was actually quite passionate in his puzzlement as to why there wasn't more outrage in the country about what the Russians had done. And he was also he also mentioned that the president himself has shown no interest in what do we do next time. And as you pointed out, it's still going on. So why is there no attention at the political level in this country as to, you know, what we should be doing and what the country should be doing to protect itself if the very foundation of American democracy is under attack?
Well, Ian, the insidiousness of intelligence operations compared to, say, terrorist activity is that it's invisible. So particularly with the kind of measures that Russia has taken that involve things like propaganda and disinformation, they're happening and they're distorting the way that we receive information, how we then create the lens through which we view our own institutions, but it's happening at a subconscious level. We don't see it. There isn't a big explosion. There aren't dead bodies everywhere. That's what people pay attention to. And when you tell people the Russians are doing this and they're distorting our democracy, people, if they can't see it, they don't want to believe it, or they don't think it's as big of a problem. And that's really part of the advantage that Russia has, is that until it is taken seriously and it's exposed and seen for what it is, it's going to continue to be able to have an effect on our society. But I do think that in many ways, it does start with the leadership. And when the President of the United States himself is calling it a hoax and denying that it's happening, I think it makes it easier for the American people to dismiss it as well.
Well, in your article at Politico, How Facebook Changed the Spy Game, you talk about how we have to find a balance between national security interests and constitutional rights. But you say it's clear that our current counterintelligence strategy hasn't caught up to the age of asymmetrical information warfare. And until it does, we'll be silently allowing our freedoms to be manipulated to make Russia great again. So that seems to be the great irony here, a country where their individual rights have been rolled back systematically by Putin, and he's taken over the press almost totally in Russia. At the same time as he's clamping down on freedom of the press and information and basic human rights in Russia, he is actively exploiting our open society. That is highly ironic, surely.
It is ironic, and it's part of what makes it so terrible that these are freedoms that we cherish, the freedom of speech and freedom of press. We keep our government away from it because we want people to express themselves freely. But as a result, Russia, and make no mistake, they understand our constitution, they understand our laws, they understand our legal limitations in being able to stop things like propaganda. They take advantage of that gap to operate. And it becomes very difficult, and particularly with regard to propaganda and disinformation. These are the kinds of cases that I conducted in the FBI, and they're very difficult because the FBI has to walk a very fine constitutional line in terms of trying to stop this activity, but also not infringe on legitimate constitutional rights. And as a result, there aren't that many tools in this particular kind of operation for us to stop it, compared to, say, something like theft of trade secrets or espionage involving stolen defense information. That's the kind of thing we normally think of as, you know, foreign intelligence activity, and we can be more aggressive in stopping that. There are laws that we can prosecute people. Propaganda and disinformation is very hard because we don't want to become like Russia and clamp down on First Amendment rights and expression. But on the other hand, we do need to understand that we're in a new age where this particular threat has a broader reach than propaganda might have had 20 years ago because of social media and the way that it can exponentially go globally around the world.
And again, I'm speaking with Usha Rangappa, who's Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law, and she was served as a special agent at the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and she has an article at Politico, How Facebook Changed the Spy Game. So you point out in your article at Politico that the FBI has a legal duty to stop or neutralize foreign intelligence operations occurring on U.S. soil. So this is the challenge, obviously. How do you stop a foreign intelligence operation that is not the same as recruiting spies or stealing defense secrets, etc.? What can the FBI do? Because the idea, for example, of FBI agents telling journalists that they shouldn't print things because they're being manipulated by the Russians, that is a very slippery slope, obviously.
It is a very slippery slope, and, you know, the FBI has a checkered past in that arena under Hoover in the 70s, and as a result, there are now a lot of firewalls between the FBI and even their ability to talk to journalists. You know, I personally experienced the approvals and the hurdles that you go through to do that because that is something that they want to do as a last resort. I think the important thing to understand is that counterintelligence has traditionally been based on a human source model. So foreign intelligence agencies are human intelligence-based organizations. They recruit people on the ground to do their dirty work. You know, our CIA recruits their sources to get their secrets or do what they do abroad. And what's different now is that the Russians don't need to recruit people. They don't need to recruit journalists. They don't even need to be on the ground in the United States. There's Facebook and there's Twitter, and they can have a troll farm sitting in Russia that's creating fake accounts and doing it from over there. So, you know, you're no longer dealing with people. You're dealing with companies, and you're dealing with these fake accounts that are, you know, managed abroad, and in some cases that are not even managed by people. They're just bots, you know, these automated accounts or information that's pushed out. And so the human-based counterintelligence model is going to be very ill-equipped to counter this particular kind of threat. And we're going to need to increasingly rely on private companies like Facebook and Twitter to vet, authenticate accounts, to report bots and report suspicious accounts that may be coming from essentially foreign intelligence services abroad, to allow the FBI to intervene while neutralize these operations as they're in progress, as opposed to after the fact, which is kind of what's happening right now.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you in your Politico article, you mentioned that the FBI has conducted perception management campaigns against foreign intelligence services trying to penetrate the United States with its influence, to influence U.S. policy, and also target politicians under the guise of legitimate lobbying. there's no more, I think, evident case of that than the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower, surely, with all those Russians with intelligence ties, meeting with Donald Trump Jr., the campaign manager for the Trump campaign, and Jared Kushner. There's evidence that went on. I know the special counsel Robert Mueller is looking into that, but that seems pretty unprecedented. I don't know that's ever been that brazen, has it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think there have definitely been, in that piece, I think I linked to at least one article that became public, that became a criminal prosecution of a Pakistani ISI intelligence officer, excuse me, posing, running a lobbying firm and trying to influence U.S. policy towards Pakistan. This definitely, what was interesting and what might be unusual about the Trump Tower meeting is that it's intersecting with other kinds, it's potentially intersecting with other Russian operations that were also ongoing. So, for example, if Russia hacked into the DNC server, obtained information from that hack, and then was trying to use that in a way to entice the Trump campaign to take it and manipulate the election, you're having an intersection here between criminal activity, two different counterintelligence operations coming together. So it's very sophisticated. This is a little bit different in the sense that it's not just, a recruited spy pretending to be a lobbyist and just going and trying to convince a congressman to vote a particular way on a bill. This is, cyber crime. This is different active measures. This is attempting to influence an ongoing campaign and an election. So it's different in that way, and therefore I think much more problematic than what has happened in the past traditionally.
Sure, but that meeting in Trump Tower back in June of 2016, where the Russians promised compromising material on Hillary Clinton and wanted to help Donald Trump, 2 weeks later after that meeting, WikiLeaks dumped all of those, a lot of that stuff that was hacked from the DNC. So, again, there are many kind of threads there. Hopefully, at some point or other, we'll get a fuller picture. I thank you for joining us, Asha Rangappa. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Asha Rangappa, who is Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. And she previously served as a special agent at the FBI's specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. And she has an article at Politico, How Facebook Changed the Spy Game. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.